Hey everybody, this is Chris Pope, and before we get started, I wanted to let you know that the show you're about to have a listen to is actually a audio recording that we did live. So there is, during that time, we had a live chat room, and there were some visuals and stuff up on the screen for video feed. And, of course, this being audio, you won't be able to see that. If you'd like to see it, though, just go to commentary.guysfromandromeda.com. I think most of the content and stuff will make sense as we talk about it and all of that on this. But either way, this way you have an audio version as well as the video version. If you want it, you can go to the website. So, without further ado, here we go.
Hi, this is Lori Cole.
And this is Corey Cole.
We're the creators of the Quest for Glory series by Sierra Online.
And you're about to listen to a chat with Chris Pope.
Welcome to another episode of the Guys from Andromeda podcast. And that was a little bit of the Quest for Glory 1 VGA promotional trailer for you guys. And I apologize, I actually made a mistake. I was going to show the EGA one first and I accidentally popped in the VGA one. But I have the EGA one. I'm going to put that one on during the show as well. So I hope everybody's doing great. It has been a while since you guys have had to listen to my redneck voice. It's probably a good thing, right? It's good. It's good to be back. Good to have the show running again. I'm really excited. I'm crazy excited about the guests that I've got on, and I know you guys are as well. You've made that very clear with the emails and all that jazz. So before I do that, let me say a couple quick announcements. First off, yes, there is such a thing as Living Concept Art 5, and yes, it comes out very, very, very soon, I promise. And there is been some things that have happened, and a lot of the focus has been on the real game. But it's ready. It's ready. It's coming out. We promise. You should hear something within the next couple of days for sure. And if not, then come to one of the conventions that I'm about to be at, and you guys can punch me right in the face. All right, you have my permission. All right, which is the next thing. We have some conventions that we're going to be involved in pretty soon. Dragon Con in Atlanta. I will be there coming up on August 31st through September 3rd. Maybe one of the two guys will be there. I'm not sure. Those guys are, they got their heads together, taking care of some stuff. And Scott's been in Europe doing some stuff and he's on his way back, but we'll see. And then, we'll all be at GMX, the Geek Media Expo, which will be on, the 26th of October through the 28th. Myself and the guys from Andromeda, a bunch of other cool people like Veronica Belmont, Rob Paulson, Ellen McLean, a lot of my friends. I think you guys will really enjoy meeting if you can get up there. Billy West, a bunch of people, Ben Padden. So get out there and check it out. It's in Nashville, Tennessee, if you guys can make it. Yes, Nashville, Tennessee. Sorry, I didn't say that. October 26th through the 28th. All right, without further ado, let me get past all of that stuff and get into the reason why everybody is probably here, and that is to hear from my very special guest, the makers of Quest for Glory, amongst many other games that are just awesome, Lori and Corey Cole. Lori and Corey, how's it going?
Going fine.
Excellent.
Hi, it's Corey. It's going great.
Excellent. That's great. Well, it's really awesome to hear from you guys. I know the fans and everything out there have been going crazy. I don't think we could have done this podcast soon enough for everybody. But we did in a relative amount of time. I mean, we were just at Comic-Con together, and it wasn't that long ago. So we pulled it together, and the moons have lined up. And you guys have got some really cool announcements that you're going to be making, some of which I'm sure you've already made, but still really awesome. You guys are up in Oakhurst still, right?
Yep, right where Sierra used to be.
Yeah, so you've just been, you just continued up there. I've often wondered if any of the Sierra people actually had stayed at Oakhurst, if they had moved on or what happened. So it's really cool to hear that you guys are, still there and stuff. That's awesome. So
Well, it's one of those things, like looking outside our window a few minutes ago where we had the deer in our yard, walked up to the bird feeder and was eating bird seed. And it's just not something you get in the middle of the big cities.
Sure. No, that's cool, man. That's really neat stuff. Well, you guys, and I think we told the fans this already. When we do our wrap party in Oakhurst, everybody, hopefully, coming up this next year, Lori and Corey have agreed to come to the wrap party. I only had to threaten them a little bit and blackmail them a little bit. Other than that, they
I'm told I need to increase my pledge in order to qualify for that.
That's right. You're a few thousand short there, Corey. You need to up that now. It's awesome though. And actually, the Coles have offered to help us find a location to have the wrap party at. So that's really awesome. So they're taking a little bit of a more active role as far as that goes, because it's been a while since any of the people were, like Scott and Mark, they haven't been there in quite a while. So getting remembering the perfect place to hold a party like that is could be interesting. So
and it changes from time to time.
Right.
But it's absolutely gorgeous out here. It's a little bit isolated. If we want to travel somewhere, the airfares are sky high, so to speak.
Right.
Yeah, that was a pun.
Cool. Well, so I guess we'll start out with the basic questions that is probably everybody's wanting to know. And by the way, you guys listening that are in the chat room, I will have some time for questions here a little bit later in the show, so you guys can ask those and all that. Let us get through some of the basic intro stuff first, and then you guys can ask those questions. So to start out with, let me ask you guys this. First off, how did you guys get into making games in general?
Well, that's one of those things that we were always playing games as kids. We grew up with games, that and books. Mm-hmm.
And, Lori at one point talked about how we had actually unknowingly set our entire educational background was all designed for making games. We just didn't know it at the time. So she studied literature and creative writing. I had the programming classes and so on. And
I had the animation classes. Mm-hmm. So
yeah.
Cool.
I even took one cartoon class, although I'm absolutely terrible as an artist.
So, but you guys started out as gamers. I remember when we had lunch, you had said something about you guys had done like Dungeons and Dragons. You used to play those kinds of games, or did you create those kinds of games, or what was that you were telling me?
Yeah, we actually met at a science fiction convention. I think it was WonderCon when I was demoing my first D&D module, which was called The Tower of Indomitable Circumstance. Mm-hmm. From Judges Guild. And I had just finally managed to get one of my scenarios published. Lori was one of the players in the game. And, she liked the way I DM'd. And I thought she was cute and smart.
Awesome.
And so we actually got together over D&D.
Oh,
I was
cool.
Also female, so that really made a big difference there. Mind you, this was at a time there were very few women that ever went
right.
to these conventions.
Oh, yeah, no doubt. Yeah, I bet that was an interesting, for you to, did you have geeks throwing themselves at you constantly?
Well, not that much, but I sure would have enjoyed that part.
Oh, that's cool. Well, and so how did you guys make your way to Sierra? Like, where did that all kind of stem from?
Well, that also happened through science fiction fandom. We had a friend, Carly Hawk's daughter, who had been doing animation for Sierra and had then moved to the Bay Area but was still working for them remotely. And we talked to Carly at a folk music party. If people haven't aren't familiar with folk music, that's folk music with science fiction fantasy themes. Mm-hmm. And Carly said that Sierra was looking for, I think it was something like a expert tournament level award-winning dungeon master or prize-winning dungeon master or something like that. Mm-hmm. And so Lori and I looked at each other and said, well, there is, of course, no such thing. But if you took each of those, if you took each of those words individually, then we could apply it to some part of our life. I had actually won a prize. I'd won first place playing a character in a D&D tournament one time. And mm-hmm. certainly we were dungeon masters. And, you know, just if you took each word individually, we had all the background. So I called up Ken Williams and talked to him on the phone. And he said, oh, that's nice. Everybody wants to be a game designer. That was kind of like, kind of cold. And he said, well, you know, what makes you think you're better than any of the others? And I said, well, you know, I'm also a programmer and I can work well with the programmers. I've just been doing this project on the Atari ST, at which point suddenly it was like the phone warmed up about 10 degrees when I said Atari ST. What I didn't know at the time, but found out later, was that Sierra Online had a big contract with Atari to convert all their games to the Atari ST, and they only had like one programmer in-house who knew anything about the ST. So they had this big contract and they couldn't do it.
Oh, wow. So things changed from that point.
So we didn't sell our game at that point. We didn't come in as a game designer, but they hired me as a programmer to do the Atari ST stuff. Mm-hmm. And I did a good job in that. But they also, you know, talked to Lori at the same time and said, well, we don't know about this Corey fellow. You know, he's a geek. He's obviously a programmer. But Lori, you know, she talks like she might be a game designer.
She sounds like she knows what she's doing, huh?
Well, I came in and proposed the whole game series of Quest for Glory, and they liked several words there. One, it was a quest, because that meant their brand sort of thing was going. And two, it was a series. They could get more than one game out of it. And they liked that part, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we called it Heroes Quest at the time, which went right along with King's Quest and mm-hmm. Space Quest.
Yeah.
So, you know, we pressed all the buttons. I did a little marketing presentation for them that had similarities and differences to other Sierra games. So one important part is that we would develop it using Sierra's tools. Mm-hmm. So it would not be creating an entirely new tool set from scratch.
Yeah.
And that it had the common things, the storytelling and the puzzle solving and so on. So they liked all that. And then we said, okay, and on top of that, we'll have multiple different characters and we'll have role-playing and these other things that they had no clue about. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, and you guys, if I remember correctly, there was some issues, just like when Space Quest, they tried to get the name for Space Quest. There was a board game called Heroes Quest that caused some, you guys had to change the name to Quest for Glory. Is that correct?
Yeah. Basically, there was a Milton Bradley game mm-hmm. that was Hero Quest, and they had the trademark on that for computer games in Europe, I think it was.
Okay.
And so, therefore, they had to change our name because they couldn't sell it over there with the same name.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so yeah, it was Games Workshop in England, and then Milton Bradley was the U.S. Distributor for it. So what they said is they couldn't actually get us on U.S. trademark law, but they said, we will not allow you to distribute this game anywhere in Europe. Because of the trademark, and Sierra had to back down on that. Mm-hmm. There was also a Hero Quest thing from the people that did Rune Quest, but I don't know if that ever got anywhere. But the point to the Hero Quest board game is they had another company in the process of converting it to computers, and so that's why they didn't want a conflict.
Right. Oh no, it sounds the world, as far as I remember, with Scott and Mark telling me they had, you know, a problem with their name as well, but luckily it was just some one guy who owned the name Space Quest, and I think Ken Williams just cut him a relatively small check and basically they were able to go with their name. So they got lucky, you guys not so lucky, but you still managed to come up with a good name for it, and it worked. I mean, you know, we were talking about this too when we were in San Diego. You guys, your game was probably, well, hands down, the most sophisticated of all of the Sierra games. I mean, with with multiple characters and the skill sets that you could have and the fighting sequences that you could have. I mean, that had to have been quite a job to tackle. What was that like trying to get permission? Because it was obviously going to cost more money, or it had the potential to cost more money. What was that like trying to get them to clear that for you guys?
Well, at the time, they didn't have a lot of people there, so they really didn't know what they were doing or what they were getting into with our game. Mm-hmm. They basically just put a couple people in on our project, and gradually it sort of dragged people on into it because it badly needed more people.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, we had no clue either, so we got very ambitious with it, and it actually worked out. Because we had certain parts of the game that were optional, and we ended up stripping out some of those, like the Goblin Maze and so on. But they originally assigned us, I think, one artist and one programmer.
Yeah, our first artist was Mark Crow's brother.
Oh, wow.
Jeff. Yeah.
Oh, cool. Very cool. Yeah. I do believe you had told me Corey, you had said something about it for a while there, you were kind of worried that they were not going to allow the game to go. But you had said, who was it? Who had kind of went to bat for you or whatever.
Gruka, yeah. Actually, you know, it's interesting because Sierra at that time was a very laissez-faire. Ken Williams would occasionally wander by the cubicles and say, what do you have new to show me? And one of the rules that we were taught early on is that you should always have three new things that you have not yet shown him, and if he wandered by your cubicle, you showed him exactly one of them, because sometimes he wouldn't come by for 2 weeks, and sometimes he would come by three times in one day.
Right. Just be prepared.
If he came by a second time, you had to have a second thing to show him, and so on.
That's great.
But we were actually fairly far along in development, and done the pitches and so on. And then we had a meeting in Ken Williams' office where Ken said, you know, I really just don't get this game. And, I don't quite know what you're doing and whether it's going to sell. Mm-hmm. Lori reminded me there were actually two influences. One of them was Gruka. Gruka, like after the meeting out in the hallway, said, you know, Ken, I really love this game. Mm-hmm. At which point Ken immediately echoed back, you know, I really love this game. But as Lori pointed out, it was also Ken's son, Chris Williams, had played some of the early versions. I guess it was working as a tester at Sierra. And he said, you know, this game is really cool. Mm-hmm. This is really fun. And those two influences completely turned Ken around and said, okay, obviously there will be a market for this. And in fact, when we did ship, I think we were Sierra's fastest game ever to 100,000 copies.
Wow.
So, you know, they'd been thinking, okay, maybe it'll hit 50. Mm-hmm. It was normally, I think, 3 to 6 months to get to 100,000. We did it in a month.
Wow. Yeah. That's crazy, man. And just the very first game, Quest for Glory 1 itself, was just, you know, from the box art, which I have on the screen, to the actual graphics in the days was like state-of-the-art, cutting edge. It was on the newer SCI engine you guys were using, and it was, the music was just amazing. I mean, everything about it was just, you know, brilliant. Oddly enough, and this was actually the case for me on Space Quest as well, I actually played Quest for Glory 2 first. I had beaten almost every, you know, Sierra game. I was a Sierra junkie, so my dad and my mom would get me Sierra games for my birthday, and I got it right around the time Quest for Glory 2 came out, and I had not played Quest for Glory 1, and a friend of mine by the name of Justin Martin, who was actually Glanz Henderson, that we have on, and Guys from Andromeda, on our he's a VO guy, but he came over and spent the night one night with me during the summer or something, summertime, and we just plowed through it, and it was a tough game, but we got crazy addicted to it, I remember. And I actually have this is not my map, but like the map that came with the game, I remember has like black magic marker writing all over it because we were complete idiots and didn't even think about it bleeding through the front. So like, this is not my, like I said, this is not mine. This is a picture I found on the internet, but mine is, you can't even hardly tell the maze anymore. But from that point on, I went and begged and had to get Quest for Glory 1. And I mean, I was hooked at that point. And you know, I didn't know. I was kind of like, I'm a Police Quest, Space Quest, King's Quest kind of guy. And I don't know about this new game, but when somebody handed it to me and I tried it, you know, I was hooked. And I, you know, you can tell by your fan base, I wasn't the only one. So your games were a lot of fun. Again, great graphics, and the music was great. I think Mark Siebert did the music for you, or at least he was one of the ones that did the music for you.
Yeah,
right?
He did the original music on the first game, and that theme song, you know, you just have to listen to it, and your heart starts pumping, and mm-hmm. you really think of the game.
Yep. No, it's a.
Yeah, we were
brilliant.
Blessed with some really wonderful musicians throughout the series. Chris mm-hmm. Brayman is another one I want to call out for the work he did on Quest for Glory 2. His wife did Middle Eastern dancing and ethnic folk dancing, so he's very familiar with you know, that kind of tune, and he really got that kind of sensibility into Quest for Glory 2 and gave it, I think, a very unique feel that, you know, in general, when we do these games, they. We're always questioning ourselves and saying, is this game going to be any fun? And then about three quarters of the way through the project, when we finally start getting the music tracks onto the game, we start saying, you know, that is fun. Because without mm-hmm. the music, they lose a lot.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's I was talking to Mark about this as well, because we're going through the process of getting somebody confirming the people that are doing the music for Space Venture right now. And we were talking about how important the highest quality music is, because anybody that has played, you know, a Sierra game, you know, I don't want to go so far as to say all the music in every Sierra game was perfect, but every single game I remember playing had some good music in it that was really catchy. It didn't matter, you know, whether it was the Space Quest, King's Quest, Police Quest, Quest for Glory, Leisure Suit Larry, any of those, they all had, every one of those games had a couple or more songs that were really catchy, and you really enjoyed playing the game partly because of the music, even though a lot of people only had like an ad lib or a sound blaster or whatever. They didn't have the Roland. The music was still good, even though it wasn't as good as the Roland MT32, you know. But yeah, and somebody just said it in the chat room, and I was actually playing it earlier in my my sound check, but Quest for Glory 1 actually had probably, I would have to say, my all-time favorite song on any of the Sierra games, which is a Mark Siebert song, and it was the Around Us Peace song. I really just love that song. He put that together so well.
That's extremely popular. Yeah. There are quite a few versions of people doing covers on it on YouTube mm-hmm. and so on, and so it's that one really struck a chord, so to speak.
Yeah. Yeah, no doubt. And in the graphics, too, it was really cool. The tree and the mountain background and all that was just really brilliant. I remember I would go, you know, I'd be in a ticked off mood and I'd run my character to that part after school and just go to that part and I could, you know, listen to it. It was kind of mood music. Well, you know, when you're a little punk teenager like I was. But, you know, really good stuff. And that's just another example of some of the brilliance, you know, there. Not just you guys, the game developers, but the people putting the music together and all. So, what can you give me any of the hardships you had during the making of Quest for Glory, the very first Quest for Glory? Like, what were some of the ups and downs and all that?
There were many. Mm-hmm. One of the things, actually, I was just going to say, as far as Adlib and the Sound Blaster Pro, is a lot of our fans dreamed of having something like that. There were actually people using the original IBM PC speaker with one voice playing horrific versions of our music through it. My first job, you know, with the Atari ST was to convert the music over to the four voices in the Atari ST. And didn't sound too bad on that, but you know, MT32, by the time you got up to that, was a huge step up. As far as problems we had, a lot of it was just you know, our inexperience and lack of realism. We wanted to have a centaur character as one of the playable characters, and Bob Heitman at Sierra very quickly disabused us of that. He said, okay, here's one of your first rooms. You have a stairway there. Do you know what it would be like to animate a centaur or any kind of four-legged creature climbing those stairs? It just won't look good. Mm-hmm. But I think our biggest problem was the floppy disks, the fact that we had to make this work on 5 1/4-inch floppy disks that were 360K each. And people at that time, a lot of them did not even have hard drives. Mm-hmm. Pardon my phone there. So that they were playing off of a floppy, which means that you had to have all the critical code for the game had to be on every single floppy. We're also talking about computers that only had 640K of memory, mm-hmm. not megabytes K.
Right.
So they were constantly swapping floppies. So we really had to design the games to those restrictions. I think we used 8 or 10 5 1/4-inch floppies for the first game, which was like unheard of. Sierra, again, almost canceled the game when they found out how many disks it would take because they couldn't figure out how they could afford to sell the game with the cost of goods there.
Right, right. Oh, yeah. Yeah, because at that point, you're saying, where are we going to get the profit at here? We're, the game's going to sell a lot, but it's also going to cost a lot. Yeah. No, that's good. And it, but, you know, it ended up working out. So
you have any hardship stories so that you care to repeat, Lori?
Well, we had to improvise the whole time. We had to figure out what was working, what wasn't. And, of course, Corey wasn't even on the project initially, because he was off on the Atari ST stuff. So therefore, I was all by my lonesome trying to figure out how to do something, dealing with these programmers and these artists. And it was an interesting learning experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, especially considering it's the first time, you know, you had done anything like that. But it was not just the first time for you. This was the first time anybody at Sierra had ever tackled a project in which there you had a game with this many elements going on at one time. So, yeah, I can imagine, it had to have been, some hurdles. Do you remember how long it took to make the game?
I think it was about 10 or 11 months. Mm-hmm.
So, therefore, we were working the whole time trying to, work within the constraints of Sierra, wanting to get it out for Christmas the next year when I started, and fighting the fact we didn't have every team member on, and we kept losing team members, and they put different people on. So the fact that we actually made a reasonable deadline was pretty much amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Well, like when you guys said it just took you that amount of time, I was really surprised. I mean, considering the amount of stuff you had to pack into the game, and it turned out so brilliantly. And then, how long did you finished Quest for Glory 1? How long was it between Quest for Glory 1 and Quest for Glory 2? You guys started making that.
Not very long at all. It was pretty much back to back.
I was trying to think if we even had a day off.
Yeah.
No, I don't think so. I think they wanted us to go right back into it. They didn't know if it would sell or not, but they had all those people, and they wanted to put them to work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, might as well go ahead and get, let's hope for the best and keep moving, right? No, that's cool.
The first game shipped in October, and we had a panic at the very end. There was one room, the cave with the kobold, where you fight the kobold, was actually not working. And we were about to ship the game, and I ended up making a deal with management where they put all of the game into production except for the disc with that room. And I spent two or three solid weeks completely rewriting the code of that room, getting it through a test cycle, and then they finally duplicated that disc after all the other ones, put the packages together, and got the game out in October.
Oh, wow.
So it was, and normally they would not allow that, but they knew that they only had a certain number of duplicating machines, and the game had gotten a lot more pre-orders than they expected. So they knew that if they had to hold off the entire game, it wouldn't have shipped till November.
Mm-hmm.
So we started that immediately, and then we went immediately on to Quest for Glory 2. We had planned out four games in the series to start with, so we knew where we were going with it, and we had put a little bit of foreshadowing. Mm-hmm. At the end of the game, but it was still pretty crazy. And then two was also when all heck broke loose.
Yeah, we were starting out. We thought we knew what we were going to be doing when we came to two. Here we'd had a game under the belt. We were ready to go with number two. We thought we knew the rules, and we thought we knew what mistakes we had made on the first one, and we weren't going to make it on the second. And then Sierra changed the rules entirely of how to make a game between one and two.
Wow. Really?
Yeah, that had to do with bringing in a new art director. Bill Davis is the VP or director of creative design. And Bill was from a Hollywood advertising background. Mm-hmm. And so the first thing he said is, you know, we've got to streamline this process and make it more efficient. And that means that we're not going to do any production in this game until we have storyboarded out the entire game. And so I had huge, basically like cubicle dividers set up with just row after row of pencil sketched or pen sketched storyboards for the entire game. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, at the same process, they were switching over to 256 color VGA and to the new interpreter. Mm-hmm. And with the VGA, they wanted to do all the artwork as paintings and scan them in.
Oh, yeah.
And we had a very difficult decision to make at that point because Sierra wanted to make sure they got some game out that year. Mm-hmm. That would have been 1990, I guess. And if they switched all the games over to the new system, then they wouldn't have gotten anything out at all.
Right.
So we had some discussion. Mark and Scott decided to delay their game by about 6 months and mm-hmm. help out on the other projects. And our game was selected as the one that would go out in 1990, staying with the old parser and the 16 color and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But we still had to use all the process of the 256 color process. So it was just a complete reworking of how everything was done. Everything had to be up front instead of done as we went.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's I remember that well. I remember 1990 because that was when I got Quest for Glory 2, it seems like. And there wasn't a lot of Sierra games coming out at that time. And well, that's that, you know, it worked out. And again, yet again, you guys came out Quest for Glory 2. I still, and again, it could be because it was the very first one I ever played, but it's probably my favorite in the series. I enjoyed it the most of all of them. I liked them all, but, you know, just like I always say, Space Quest IV was my favorite Space Quest, and, you know, and King's Quest V was my favorite King's Quest, and all of that. I have a favorite in each series, but, yeah, I really love that. But one thing I wanted to ask, too, what was the story behind, like, in Trial by Fire, Quest for Glory 2, when you, I think it's either you beat it or it's the intermission part of it. You advertise game, the third game, which was going to be, what was it, Shadows of Darkness, I believe. But it ended up not being Shadows of Darkness. It ended up being a different game.
That's because of several things. For one thing, at the end of two, we really thought the next thing we would be doing is swinging over and doing game number four would be, game number three, and that would be Shadows of Darkness. Mm-hmm. But instead, Ken Williams decided that Sierra should go into kids' games. And therefore, he had all the game designers come in and basically do a bid for doing kids' games, educational games, because we were going to be the next educational game out there. I mean, the game company out there.
Mm-hmm.
So Corey and I pitched a couple, and Corey wound up doing Castle of Dr. Brain, and I did Mixed Up Fairy Tales, and we had this big year gap between Quest for Glory 2 and the project we were going to do, the next Quest for Glory. And meantime, somebody else that was working there, Ellen Guan, who's since gone on to several game companies after that, said, you know, what you really have, I really loved the characters Rakish and Uhura. You're really, you know, obviously the next game is set in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And we thought about it, and Shadows of Darkness was always going to be the game. It's going to be horror. It's going to be very different from any other the games we were doing. It mm-hmm. was going to break the mold. And it was like, oh my gosh, we've had this year hiatus, and do we want to suddenly do this dark horror comedy thing that's not like anything else? Or we could do something that would, you know, follow up better on game number two and be easier for people that have never played the series before to get into. Mm-hmm. So that's why we went with Wages of War, set in Fricana, and following some different characters that we had followed. And basically came up with the idea of your character is thrown into Africa and needs to learn very fast the cultures and the different people that were part of that land. Mm-hmm. So there was nothing familiar in the background for the player to relate to. He really had to learn what was going on. Mm-hmm. Well, and so it was about, cool. a lot about making friends and influencing people.
Oh, yeah. Well, that interesting, yeah. you know, approach.
And of course, at this point, my life changed a little also because... if you recall, Lori was mentioning that she had to do the beginning of Heroes Quest herself because I was off doing Atari ST. The company at this point decided that they really needed an experienced system programmer to do the port of all the games over to the Sega Genesis CD. So I was pulled off onto that project for a full year. So Quest for Glory 3 was done almost 100% by Lori. I did write a little bit of, you know, some of the text messages and so on, and I did some editing and playtesting on it, and I was in the initial brainstorming sessions, but basically that one is almost entirely her game.
Once again, it broke the rules. All of a sudden, the whole rules of how to do a game had changed. We were into point and click. All of a sudden, the interface was very much, you know, using the icons, and that gives a whole different feel for the game. Mm-hmm.
And simultaneously, just as Lori was working on Quest for Glory 3, at the same time, she was redesigning Heroes Quest to be Quest for Glory 1 VGA, which used the point-and-click interface. Mm-hmm. So those two projects, I think, launched the same year, didn't they?
I think so.
So, you know, it was basically she was, you know, designing and directing two projects at the same time.
Busy.
Yeah.
Very cool. Yeah, I remember you guys used the, like, it might have been the first game from Sierra that used like claymation effects or something, didn't you, for the VGA?
Yes, we did. Actually, the art designer decided that we would basically sculpt out all of the characters, their faces, in clay. Mm-hmm. And I actually have two of the original claymation things.
Oh, awesome.
One of them was a Fenris the Rat, and I have Abdullah Du from the Inn. Mm-hmm. And they would do that, then they would scan those in, and then they would animate over them. So it wasn't true claymation in the sense they weren't actually moving the clay model to make the voices. Mm-hmm. But they effectively wanted a very different art style because of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was very cool. I do remember watching the intro for that, which I've got on the screen right now, I was blown away. I'd never seen anything like that before. So... and essentially I'd always kind of had a bad taste in my mouth when it came to the remakes of the games. I've always been like, oh, the classic, you know, the original.
Mm-hmm.
But I really did like the way that the effects came out on this one. It was definitely one of the ones that I thought, wow, they did a good job with that, for sure. So,
and it's
really cool.
Still very beautiful. I mean, you mm-hmm. see those screens up there and I'm going, wow, that's really very
yeah.
cool.
Yeah. Even, you know, it still holds up, even in today's, now I know some of the kids today would be like, well, that's just okay graphics. Let me get my Xbox 360 out. But you know, back then it was amazing. And then still looking at it today, it's like, it's good stuff, you know? It's way better than than obviously the old, 16 color days, but, those are still the classics, you know? So, but that was great. And then, so eventually you guys did get to make, number four, which was Shadows of Darkness, it came out pretty good. I really had a great time playing it as well, and yeah, definitely the whole horror kind of thing you had going on that one was neat.
We had a great team coming in on it. We had great programmers. We had AI of the monsters was very complex. It had a different combat system, like everything. We were reinventing the wheel when we start over. We were trying everything new. but it really, we were so excited about it. It was my favorite storyline. It was beautiful art, and it comes out, and it has 1 week of QA, and they put it out to the market.
Wow.
Yeah, that was, I think the two buggiest games in the series were 2 and 4. two had a few killer bugs, but, they managed to get patches for those fairly quickly, but 4 really was shipped out long before it was ready. As far as changing the rules, there were relatively few. The big difference was that I was no longer I think I had stopped being a Sierra employee by the time we did 4 and was now a contractor like Lori. Lori was never an employee until Quest for Glory 5. Mm-hmm. So I actually got to work full-time. The two I worked the most on were really 1, 2, and 4. Mm-hmm. And so I got to, do more of the design. So if you see more of the Dr. Brain type puzzles in a game, that's, 2 or 4 had more of those because I had more to do with design. I like those more cerebral kind of things. They're not strictly character puzzles. Mm-hmm. The game was really, really had a lot of bugs when it shipped and crashed a lot and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Trying to remember, 4 was the one that they almost shipped completely non-working.
Yeah, it does. It was 4. 5, wow. Five we were working until Thanksgiving, and you had to go off on vacation, and I stayed at home. But we shipped the day after the weekend of Thanksgiving for 5.
Wow.
So, yeah, it was always like that at the end of a project. You put in all those hours, and then it kept going on and on, but they had to ship Quest for Glory 4 before it was actually QA'd, and that was just a tragedy. And it really didn't get fixed until I think it was 6 months afterwards. They shipped it again with the bugs all fixed and with the voice acting, and all of a sudden that was like wonderful because we had some absolutely astonishing voices for Quest for Glory 4's CD version.
Yeah, definitely the CD version was just a huge step up from the original on that. I actually got to do a lot of the voice direction and work with people like John Reese Davis and just some absolutely fabulous voice artists down in L.A. Stu Rosen was the director. I guess my title was producer or something like that, but Stu was the director. It was just absolutely amazing to work with those guys. And a lot of people ask about in Quest for Glory 4 about the Hans, Franz, and Yvonne scene where the dialogue on screen is different from the vocal version, and that was actually everybody having fun. We had decided some voice impersonations would be fun to use for that scene, so we asked the voice actors, okay, what impersonations can you do? And the one guy said, I do a pretty good Jack Nicholson. And somebody said, well, I do a good Jack Nicholson, too. And they were just enough apart that I said, if they were like brothers or something, that could work. We could actually use both of those. And they started just really ad-libbing and having fun with the dialogue. And we decided to leave most of the ad-libs in because it was just fun.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you guys really did. Like, you guys had a couple of friends of mine, actually, that were voicing characters. Cam Clark, who played, how do you say the guy's name? Domovoy?
Domovoy, yes. Cam is fabulous.
Nikolai. Cam Clark was, and he's tons of cartoons, Leonardo the Ninja Turtle and all these things. Mm. Jim Cummings, who is Winnie the Pooh, and a bunch of voices. Tigger and all that. Bill Farmer, who is Disney's Goofy. Is actually, he voiced Leshy. Jess Harnell was Franz, and Jess Harnell is actually Wacko the Animaniac, amongst many, many, many other characters that he's voiced. So you guys had a, that's just, Jeff Bennett, you guys had a very amazing team of voice actors, voicing characters in that. That's just a few of the good ones. I mean, you guys had a full cast of really, really good, high-profile people.
And I've loved voice acting all my life. I actually considered it at one time. You know, my heroes, I got to go to a con once that had Mel Blanc, and it had June Foray, mm-hmm. and all these people that were the classic voices at that time. And it was like, this is just an awesome experience. So it was a real honor and a pleasure to actually have these people on the game. And that's where you get the highs of making a game. You know, these were the high points. You got to work with talented people, and they were doing what they loved best.
Yeah, they do. Voice actors, you know, they love their job. Almost every one of them do. So, you know, yeah, definitely. Actually, and I apologize. I can't believe I forgot to mention this. Yeah, Cam Clark. Somebody said it in the chat room. Cam Clark, who I'd mentioned, not only was he Leonardo the Ninja Turtle, but from Sierra fans, he was also Freddy Farkas, for those of you that played that. So he did that. And then also, I need to do another plug. You mentioned June Foray. One of the voice actors that will be voicing in Space Venture, Rob Paulson, who is also Yakko the Animaniac and Raphael the Ninja Turtle and Pinky from Pinky and the Brain and all that. he does a podcast for me on one of my podcasting network, actually, called Talking Toons with Rob Paulson. This next week, he's actually doing a podcast with June Foray.
Oh, really?
Yeah, wow. And it's gonna be really cool. So you guys should check that out, robpaulsonlive.com. Little shameless plug there for his show, but June Foray, I mean, heck, that is a living legend. That's like, you know, Gary Owens has, you know, been doing it forever, and June Foray is another one of those that has been in this business, the voice acting business, for just ever.
Yeah, you know, we could summarize it to say that you don't have a game until all the pieces are there. So, you know, it takes a good game design, it takes great storytelling, interesting puzzles, you know, wonderful graphics, great music, great sound effects, and the voice acting just adds one more layer. And when you have everything working together, that's when you look back on having worked a year or two or 3 years of 12-hour days, six or 7 day weeks, and say, you know, maybe it was worth it.
Yeah, it was worth the headaches, but it paid off, and you ended up making something amazing that people love. So, I mean, heck, that's the way to go. Well, at this point, I mean, heck, guys, Sierra, your time with Sierra ended. You know, you've kind of doing other things, and then boom, the Kickstarter thing hits, and I'm sure you guys have been kind of thinking for a while you might do another game, but lo and behold, we meet at San Diego Comic-Con, and sure enough, you guys are doing another game. So what can you share with the people about this?
Basically, the stars are aligning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've said for years, you know, because when we got out of the adventure game industry, it was basically, the computer game industry was basically because nobody was making adventure games. All we saw was first-person shooter after first-person shooter. And I've got nothing against that that kind of game other than the fact that I can't play them. They make me seasick. Mm-hmm. But we said, you know, there's no real story to these things. There's no real reason to be making yet another first-person shooter. And people were not looking for games that were emphasizing story and characters and so on like we made.
Right.
And the reason for that is because it became too expensive. Mm-hmm. When they started going to 3D art for everything, that it used to take 1 week when we were doing Heroes Quest for the artist to do the room background, one artist to do the room background and all the animation for a room. By the time we were up to Quest for Glory 5, it took a month just to paint the room background and do all the 3D modeling stuff necessary, and then all the characters and all the other things that happen in the room. You know, it would take 3 months per artist to do a room. Mm-hmm. And it was just too expensive to make adventure games anymore. So we said, we'd love to keep doing these games, but nobody can afford to make them. And started looking at things. How can we, you know, make cheaper art and so on? And there weren't any good answers. Mm-hmm. Well, over the intervening 10 years, things have changed a lot. And what's happened is that new tools like Unity make it a lot easier to do game development. People were willing to play 2D graphics. Doesn't have to be 3D. And there are a lot of talented developers out there and a lot of tools that make it a lot easier to make games and less expensive. But, you know, it still costs a lot to make a game. And then the Kickstarter and Tim Schafer came along and with his Double Fine Adventure. And suddenly we saw that you could get a huge amount of money by crowdfunding. And unlike, you know, a developer like Sierra that had, I think, 250% overhead. So, you know, you had a tiny percentage of the budget actually went to the game development. With Kickstarter, you can put 60% into the actual game development. And we said, yeah, this might just be possible. And then we were talking with Oded Sharon and the team at Adventure Mob and had been doing some work for them. They were interested in doing something with us. And then, as Laurie said, the stars aligned. We had someone who had actually contacted us back in 2010 and had wanted to do a game with us. You know, we rather liked the indie game he had done. And he came out with a new one this year and had sent it to us. And we looked at this new game. The development team is called Brawsome. They're down in Australia. And he has a new game out this year called MacGuffin's Curse, which is just a boatload of fun. I recommend everybody go get up on Steam and get yourself a copy of MacGuffin's Curse. And we looked at the graphics of that and said, you know, we could do a game that is more of a role-playing game and less of an adventure game, but still have all the things that we love to do of, you know, interesting characters and relationships and storyline, and make a really exciting game on this. And we can do it for a budget that can be made today, and said, let's do a Kickstarter. Now, that doesn't mean we're doing it right away, because we've been working on this for, what, a month or two now, Lori? We're still in the early stages of preparation. We plan to start the Kickstarter in late October. Mm-hmm. And run through my birthday at the end of November. Just seemed like a fun time to do it. There's a lot of pieces to put into place before we can even start that. We want to have, you know, some sample screenshots, you know, video and so on. And, you know, we want people to, we're kind of trying to build up word of mouth now so that when we start the campaign, we can hit the ground running.
Well, we really think that the Kickstarter should be fun. I mean, for everybody involved, all the fans, you know, this is kind of like a reward, too. We'll have lots of different things going on. We'll keep updating every week or every day if we can. You know, we'll really keep it exciting because it's part of the process. I mean, what makes a Kickstarter successful is people wanting to come back and see what's next. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so for us, Kickstarter is actually like, you know, an interactive movie of its own. We'll be playing a game and interacting with the fans all through it. We're looking for super fans to help out, and we've started putting out the word to those. Laura, you want to talk a little bit about what the game's going to be, or would you like me to do that?
We can put down what we're trying to do. You know, basically, it's going to be more role-playing than adventure game. It's going to look more like a role-playing game, but, you know, it's all about the story, what it comes down to. It's really about the people,
yep,
the characters you meet, trying to stay alive in a difficult situation.
The game is based on something we've been doing for the last 6 years online. We had a thing called How to Be a Hero, and then... change that into the School for Heroes. And the game is going to be the game of the School for Heroes. We are starting out, we were looking at the wizard character. We didn't want everyone to think we're doing a Harry Potter clone, even though we came first. We are actually going to start out with the first character will be the rogue character. Mm-hmm. We're starting out, we're basically, we have a lot of backstory for, you know, why you were a thief. You get caught and you're given a choice. You can either go and spend the rest of your life rotting away in prison, or you can go to reform school where they'll teach you to be a respectable citizen. Mm-hmm. Well, that's the story that the authorities get. What's really going on is that the person that recruits you is looking for rogue heroes. So he is looking for people that have the skills of a thief, but really have a heroic attitude and will do great deeds. And so he is inducting you along with some other rogues into the School for Heroes, and you're going to learn how to be a hero, but you're also going to learn how to improve your skills. And then that's one level of the plot, and there's going to be, if you're familiar with the Japanese Persona and Persona 2 games, we have some of those elements where on one level, you're at the school, you're interacting with the other students, and you have a lot of role-playing opportunities and a lot of personal relation type things there. And then at some point, you discover that you really need to go down into the catacombs beneath the school. And that's where it turns into, I kind of want to say a roguelike game, but it's not much like Rogue. We have much better graphics and very little randomness. There's real, the story continues down in the dungeons, but there's a lot of tactical combat. You'll be able to do some maneuvering around like you did in Final Fantasy Tactics, be able to use all of your rogue skills to fight your way through the catacombs and discover the secrets that are hidden down below. And the things you learn in your class you'll be using down there, but also the skills that you and the equipment that you obtain in the dungeon will help you to do better in school.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow, man, you guys really got a lot of this information scoped out and together. That's really good. It's good to hear that you've already got this mapped out so well.
And as you can see, we learned so well from our previous experiences that we know now to keep games simple. So we're not putting any complexity or anything challenging in here. I'm sure this is something we'll kick out in a week or two, right, Lori?
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Again, it's a series. Unlike Quest for Glory, these characters are very distinctive. The fighter, the magic user, the rogue character, the thief character. They're very distinctive characters instead of just alter egos for one another. And so as you play as the fighter, your storyline is very different and you're meeting different characters. So it really is a different game. So each one will be a unique experience.
Yeah.
So we're going to keep the setting the same. We're going to have the same school, but the catacombs are going to change dramatically. Oh, there's that deer outside the window again. Sparklies. Each one is going to have a very different story and very different interactions with the teachers and the students. And we're really going to have three different games. Our current plan actually is that, you know, if we raise enough from the Kickstarter to do multiple games, later on, once we have some funding from the games themselves, then we'll have the Paladin game as an unlockable. You will only be able to play as a Paladin if you have completely solved at least one of the other characters. Will again have their own story. And then if all goes well with this, then we have sequels planned with new settings and different things going on. But it's all based around the concept of the School for Heroes, which on our website, theschoolforheroes.com, we're not running the school right now. We're not accepting assignments because we just don't have time to do it right now. But that is set up to let people take all these fantasy game tropes and ideas, the ideals of the hero of Ultima 4, the quest for the Avatar and our games, and take those into real life and say, it's time for somebody to stand up and be a hero and stand up and do what's right. Mm-hmm. So our games have always had that kind of moral and ethical sense to them, and we're trying to cross over that line between real life and the games.
Mm-hmm. Oh, very cool, man. It's just great to see. Number one, I think I can speak for everybody. It's great to see you guys back into making some more games, but it's also to see how well you guys have got this planned out already, and I can't wait to see how it all goes. And at this time, because we are gonna start wrapping the show up, guys in the chat room, now's your chance. Fire some questions off, because we'll start wrapping the show up here. But yeah, man. So and you guys have announced approximately when the Kickstarter will possibly be again. When did you say that was again?
End of October. Right around the next to last week of October.
Very cool. Yeah.
Yeah, we're although we think that failure is a great learning experience, we're really not that fond of failing, and so we want to make sure that when we do our Kickstarter, it is going to be absolutely the best we can make it. We want to make sure that the game is the absolute best we can make, and that we have enough preparation done that the moment we're funded, we're going to have. Actually, we've already started working with Blossom a little bit in the planning stage, but we want to be able to get them to hit the ground running and ourselves to be pushing, so that we will get the game out as quickly as we can make it, the highest quality we can, and so. You know, we want everything to be right. And that's why we didn't rush out. You know, we first started, you know, seeing some of these very successful Kickstarter projects. We said, okay, we're not going to jump in and, you know, do a half-baked Kickstarter campaign and try to get some funding. We want to know exactly what we're going to do, have the game we want to make, and have it ready to go. And then, when it's all ready, then we're going to do the campaign.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great idea. You know, like that's one of the things I actually said on that panel was that, you know, if you can give it a little time, put a little bit more thought into it, and plan things out, then take the time to do it. In the beginning, it was definitely one of those things where they were popping up right and left, but things have kind of slowed down, and everybody, I think, is sort of trying to think through it a little bit, you know, better and get all their ducks in a row. Here's some questions for you real quick. First off, this here is a question from Orion Rezel, I think. Apologize for mispronouncing names. Says, so is the School of Heroes taking place in the Quest for Glory world, or is it possible to get the rights to use that world?
Yes and no. It's very similar world. In fact, some of the shared names, you know, similar names, a few characters that resemble Quest for Glory people, like Famous Adventure and that. But it's really not the Quest for Glory world because we don't have the rights to Quest for Glory, and we don't want to irritate people who do.
Right, right. Okay.
Yeah, we actually, we've talked to a couple of different companies that are talking to Activision about getting the rights. One of the problems is, with the success of all these indie games that and of adventure games in general, that Activision is starting to say, it might be time to bring back adventure games, and they're looking seriously at bringing back some of them, their series themselves. But that's probably at least a year off. So I think there might actually be a return of Quest for Glory in the future, but we don't know for sure. In the meantime, you know, obviously, a lot of the ideas that were in Quest for Glory came from work we had done before that. Someone mentioned Erasmus and Fenris. Those actually started out from a comic that Lori did with a friend of ours, Richard Aronson, who's also a game designer. We had a little fantasy gaming newsletter, and we had the what was that thing called originally?
Which one?
The original comic. What was the
name
of it?
The Spellbook, yeah.
Yeah, well, the magazine was called Spellbook.
Birth of a Hobbit.
Birth of a Hobbit, yeah. Back before the Tolkien estate decided you couldn't use the word Hobbit anywhere. but anyway, we had Birth of a Hobbit, and that was all based on a story that Richard had written about a umpty-ump level wizard who decided that he had read The Hobbit and decided that it would be really fun to be a hobbit and have adventures and simple life. And he had all these idealized concepts of what a hobbit was that but he was used to his comfort of his superpower. So, some of the characters, in particular, Famous Adventurer is making a comeback as the founder of the school, but it really is, does not really have any direct relationship to any of the Quest for Glories at all.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Very cool. Forgettable username says, Quest for Glory 5 multiplayer. It was very forward-thinking, but do they still feel like it was a good fit? This is from Forgettable Username.
Well, we thought we were going to do it right from the start. That was where Sierra wanted to go with it. Mm-hmm. In fact, they wanted to do the Quest for Glory 5 was supposed to be part of their online network game, The Realm. And basically, it wasn't going to work out that way, but when we were starting out, it was definitely supposed to be multiplayer. Mm-hmm. But as he actually says it, it was before its time. The technology had not caught up with everybody's imagination.
Right,
and the
right.
speed of which you could move people wasn't there.
Mm-hmm. And of course, we had no clue. In design-wise, you know, we had some ideas of what we wanted to do multiplayer, and we actually had a very early multiplayer demo of Quest for Glory 5, but as we went along, we started looking at all these puzzles we put into the game and saying, how well will these work in a multiplayer universe? And unfortunately, the answer in many cases was badly.
And when we did finish, after we finished the game and it had shipped, we were talking about then having on the add-in to have the multi-user or have a follow-up with the multi-user. And we were basically told by the programmer, well, the programming we've already used really won't allow it now. And you'll have to redo the whole thing. Yeah. And that was like, oh.
Yeah. Rough. Wow. Yeah. Let's see. I don't know if I can pronounce the name. Ginchilada, I think. If there are things we can do to help the Kickstarter campaign, is there a way we should contact you?
Oh, yes. We'll, you know, our website, the School for Heroes, will, theschoolforheroes.com, will have things like, we'll have updates and have ways of getting a hold of us. If you really want to help us, we've got a email us at hero@theschoolforheroes.com, and we're setting up a leaders board for all of our pre-supporters, the ones that are going to help us make this work. And we're really looking for people to be our super fans. We're going to go out to make sure you guys are as special as we can, because we really appreciate people that are going around telling people what's going on.
And we're calling it the leaders board because you people will be the leaders. Those are the ones that you know, are going to help us make this project successful, and you know, in particular in the Kickstarter campaign, but all through it, we're constantly going to need help moderating the forums and stuff like that. So we're really looking for our fans to step up and you know, and take an active part in the development. And of course, we'll also be listening to suggestions, game ideas, and stuff like that, and using the best of them.
Yeah, that's the way to do it, really. You know, get as much involvement there as you can. Ashton Powers asks, so you're going with, and this is, I guess, involving the game and the Paladin. So you're going with one class at a time, and, for example, to be able to play the Paladin class, you have to complete a different class arc. That's the question.
That is absolutely true.
Okay.
And part, basically what it comes down to is that we're going to be doing this in sequence, because we're not doing everything at the same time. Mm-hmm. We're going to concentrate on one character at a time and get that design out and get it right and clean before we go on to the next character. So it's down the line a bit before the Paladin will come out. And so unless you're going to wait until, you know, a couple of years, you're probably going to be playing some other character first anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we might change our mind about that, but you know, at the moment, we just thought that would be a cool reward for people that are committed enough to, you know, finish the game, that they can get some additional content while we're trying to work on the sequel.
Right, right. Irish Mile asks, "How much are you going to ask for your Kickstarter, or have you decided on that yet?" I guess
we're still negotiating on that. I had an initial idea. My son, who is now a marketing professional, is helping us out a lot, and he had a smaller number in mind, and I think we're going to compromise somewhere in between, but that will be determined specifically by working backwards from how much is the project going to cost. And that's one of the reasons we're doing all this advanced planning and preparation. Mm-hmm. Is by the time we go into that campaign, we're going to have a very good idea what our development budget is going to be. And we're going to set our goal so that we can make a good game for it.
Cool.
You have to understand that if you see, like, I think, what did you get, about 550,000 from your campaign?
530, and we just hit the first stretch goal, which is 550.
Okay, so people have to understand that when you see that big number of 530,000, that not all of that goes into development.
Yeah.
First of all, everybody takes out their little cuts. Kickstarter takes out
some. Uncle
Sam. Amazon payments.
Yep.
Any kind of physical premium you have, if there's T-shirts or box games or anything like that, you have to account for the cost of those. So you basically end up with somewhere in the vicinity of 50 to 60% available for the actual development.
Yeah.
So we're doing, in game development, they have what they call the backwards calendar. They say, for instance, the game must be out by Christmas of this particular year. And so you work back and say, okay, QA will take 6 weeks. So you have to work back from there. You know, packaging will take, you know, a month. So have to add that on, and eventually say, okay, well, actually, in order to ship in time for Christmas, the game needed to be done in August.
Right.
So we're doing the same thing with the development budget. It's we're saying, okay, here's all the things we want to put into the game. Here's what the programming and art costs and so on are going to be. And then based on that, we'll come up with a number for the Kickstarter.
Yeah.
We think it's probably going to be somewhere in the $300,000 to $400,000 range, but we do not have an exact number yet.
Yeah. A good friend of mine, Erdens, asks, which was your own personal favorite Quest for Glory game? I know that's always the that gets into the trying to choose your favorite child thing, but do you guys have a favorite of the Quest for Glory games?
Well, it's easy for me. Quest for Glory 4, The Shadows of Darkness, was always going to be my favorite. I mean, you know, I love the horror movie tropes that we were going to put in it, and I love the characters, and Boris Karloff, and Bela Lugosi, and we even had, and Peter Lorre was there, and a couple different things. So really, these were my favorite sort of things to tell and to make a story out of.
And, you know, I love something about all the games. I think that, one, you know, was innovative and, you know, just really worked well and, coordinated well. Two, I think was my favorite in terms of puzzles. And, it was also the fact that that was the first game that, you know, that I was on full time from the beginning and really, working in game design as well as programming. Mm-hmm. Although I actually burned out on the programming part late on, had to have someone else take over for a lot of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 4 obviously was very, very atmospheric. As a player, I think my favorite was 3 for the simple reason that I didn't work at all on the design of 3. So I got to, that's the only one I got to experience as a player.
Right, right,
and,
yeah.
And I loved it. I thought it was a great story and, you know, just wonderful atmosphere and things.
Very cool. Excellent. Well, you guys in the chat room, I need to eventually let these guys go, but thank you guys in the chat room, first off, for showing up, and Lori and Corey Cole, I cannot thank you enough for coming on the show with us. This is really cool, and it's been a blast. Is there anything else you want to tell the fans out there who are listening?
Well, we wouldn't be doing this if it wasn't for the fans, because we've had encouragement all the time, especially when Kickstarter first started up. We would get email from people saying, why aren't you doing a game? Look, you could do a game. And it was just really knowing that there are people out there who really want us to do this is the only reason we're willing to do this all over again.
Right, sure. Yeah.
And we've heard the horror stories about the Kickstarter campaigns, too. So we're not going in with any illusions. We know that. We're
it's an experience.
We're working 60 or 80 hour weeks during Kickstarter.
Yeah.
Then we get to do the game.
Yep. Yep. No, it's a process. That's just the dealing with the Space Quest fan community and all that, and myself has been a pleasure, and feel like I'm blessed every day to get to be a part of all of it, and I think you guys will. Find the experience. The experience will be very tough, but it will also be, you know, it can be fun, you know, at times. So, and rewarding if, you know, when, you know, you make it, you know, it's great. And I know you guys will. There's no doubt. I mean, Quest for Glory is a massive, you know, fan base out there. And so you guys got a lot of people that are going to make this, you know, help make this happen. And, I know that we'll be, you know, guys from Andromeda LLC will be definitely supporting, and you know, as I told you guys at Comic-Con, I'm definitely can help out in ways of any way I can. You know, hopefully help you guys get a podcast off the ground, and you know, all of that jazz. Are you guys gonna have Twitter and all that soon, or going? Or I know you have a Facebook and all that. Are you guys gonna maybe get on Twitter soon?
I have a Twitter account. I just haven't really figured out how to use it yet.
Well, we need to spend some time, and let me teach you how to use all that, because it's
sure.
A great tool. And the people
and you have fun at Dragon Con. That'll be awesome.
Oh yeah, I love Dragon Con. It's
yeah,
probably my favorite
twice,
convention.
And, so it was a lot of fun. One year we were there. We were actually on panels with Terry Brooks, because that was when we were doing Shannara.
Oh yeah, yeah.
So it's a great con.
Yeah, I loved it. Again, it's probably my favorite con. I love San Diego Comic-Con, though, but Dragon Con, there's just something about it. And so I'm really excited about that. And I'm excited about GMX, too. Don't forget, Geek Media Expo, everybody. But Dragon Con, seek me out if you guys are, any of you guys out there, there. Well, everybody, we are going to take off now. And again, thank you guys so much for showing up and hanging out with us. It's been a blast. And, you know, feel free, everybody, to check out their website, check out Facebook. We also are on, you know, our Facebook, Twitter, you name it. I'm the Chris Pope on Twitter. Guysfromandromeda.com is our website. You can email me at Chris at guysfromandromeda. And you guys have already given out your email. It's hero at the schoolforheroes.com. Is that right?
Yes. It's theschoolforheroes.com. And I have to remember that heroes is H-E-R-O-E-S.
Very cool.
Yes.
And, but the word the is part of it too.
Right. The school here. Got it.
So, cool. Yeah, thank you, everyone, for coming. Really appreciate all the support and all the questions. And thanks, Chris, for having us.
Oh, it's been a blast.
Thanks
thank
a
you.
Lot.
Very awesome. All right, everybody. See you later out there in Chat World World.
Bye-bye. We'll be right back.